Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, you'll hear audio recorded at the 2023 Advanced Therapies Week Conference, held in Miami, Florida, and focused on advancing cell and gene therapy. In a panel discussion moderated by Chris McLean, a senior vice president at Be the Match Biotherapies, experts examine challenges to conducting cell and gene therapy clinical trials and how to overcome them to expand access to care. Expert panelists include Dr. Heather Stefanski and Aaron LaCrone of NMDP Be the Match, as well as Gabby Giammarino of Moffitt Cancer Center. To read bios on the session moderator and panelists, and to access additional resources related to this panel discussion, click the link in the episode description. This is part one of a two-part episode.
We're going to have a very healthy discussion about the challenges of outsourcing cell and gene therapy clinical studies. Thank you all for joining. Thank you to the panelists for joining as well. And if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourselves, and I'll initiate the discussion with some questions. And then, as always with these panel discussions, helpful if the audience, if you have questions, please feel free to raise your hands. We'll have also some opportunity for questions at the end. So maybe I'll just go down the row here. Heather, yep. Aaron, Gabby, if you could start with introductions, and we'll move forward.
Sure. Hi, I'm Heather Stefanski. I'm Vice President of Medical Services at Be the Match, and I have been with the company now for over a year and a half, and prior to that, I was a pediatric bone marrow transplant physician at the University of Minnesota and did a lot with clinical trials. The goal for me was to always have a patient on a clinical trial, as well as sign up for the CIBMTR database. If I did that, I was for sure doing my job. And I also have a lot of experience with Kymriah, as I was part of the pivotal Eliana trial, and then also was one of the first centers to enroll a patient with when it became Kymriah for commercialization. So excited to be part of this.
Yep, thank you, Heather. Aaron?
Hi, everybody. I'm Aaron LaCrone. I'm Senior Director for Clinical Trials at Be the Match, CIBMTR. So I've been with Be the Match for about 5 years, but prior to that have about 15 years of biotech experience elsewhere, mostly in the clinical trial space.
Gabby? Hi, my name is Gabby Giammarino. I work at Moffitt Cancer Center as a clinical research coordinator. I've been in research now for about 2 years, prior to that I did have 1 year of patient care experience, specifically with blood and marrow transplant.
Thank you all. So, you know, I think we know as an industry that one of the biggest challenges that we face is clinical study recruitment. It's dogged the industry for years. There's a lot of competition for study participants. There's a lot of overlap in the therapies, honestly. And we have the benefit here of three panelists who have done a lot of work in the field, and we're trying to dig down into how do we overcome those challenges. The challenge of clinical trial recruitment is really complicated. It's not just competition for trial participants, also study design can be an issue. The ease or lack of ease with which a study can be implemented at a clinical site, so we'll get to this with the three panelists as well. But starting with study design, Heather, if you don't mind talking a little bit, we've talked about it in the past together, how important this is to do the upfront work to make sure that the study is designed, not just to meet the statistical endpoint, which of course is critical, but also to be implementable, right? And we'll talk to Gabby about this as well. Because it's seductive when you're designing a trial to add lots and lots of other sort of data points that you might collect during the study. Sometimes the collection of those extra data points renders the study hard to implement. So starting, Heather, with study design, of course you've been involved in this prior times in your career. Can you share with the audience some significant factors in your mind for a cell therapy study, for the design of that study, to not only meet statistical endpoints, but also have an implementable trial?
Yes, those are really great questions and things to think about. And as I look back, you know, on the clinical trials that I was on, you know, what I realized is that there are certain things that are standard of care, right? As you go along with certain endpoints that are standard of care. If it's a bone marrow transplant trial,
you know, if something happens like veno-occlusive disease, or they have low hemoglobin and low platelets, you know, thrombocytopenia, anemia, those are expected outcomes that you should not be collecting adverse events. So in thinking about that piece, like, what sort of adverse events do you want to collect? And then also, what research? What's research and what standard of care? Because if it's standard of care and there is an abnormal value, you don't want to have to collect that data point, for example. And if it's, if every patient is going to have an elevated liver function test, then why would you want to collect that, per se, if that's already known? Whereas if you are looking at immune reconstitution, those are things that you are actually going to care about, and they're going to mean something to your clinical trial. So taking a step back and thinking about standard of care versus research, and then also really thinking about the site. So if all of a sudden, you know, you need labs for research on all of these days, and it has to be day five, for example, well, what if day five is on a Saturday? You know, then all of a sudden the site is going to get dinged, or having a, you know, they're going to have to report that to the IRB, because the IRB wants to know every single time you don't do something that you're supposed to. And so if that's going to happen, then the site's not going to be happy, because they're going to have to then let the IRB know, and then they're potentially going to have to get a CAPA, right, or a corrective action plan for this. So taking a step back and saying, okay, what do we really need to collect? And then also, what are the goals of that? You know, if you think you want absolutely everything, you don't need absolutely everything. What is going to get your product to commercialization the fastest? And take it to be more simple is the better way to go. And I'd be interested to see what the other panelists think about that.
I would as well. And Aaron, if you don't mind, I'm gonna skip over you, but come back to you. And so, Gabby, of course, you are boots on the ground, so to speak, on this, right, at Moffitt. And I know when we did our prep session, you described that you've been involved with many studies. Love you to share your experience with the audience implementing studies at Moffitt, things that went well, things that didn't go well, along the lines of what Heather's talking about.
Yeah, we've had plenty of different trials, come to a start, come to an end. One thing I have noticed, especially working in blood and marrow transplant, you know, we have, of course, all of the patients are coming from hematology, so that's a whole other area that have their own clinical trials. And one specific thing that we run into quite frequently is kind of the bridging of the financial authorizations. Sometimes when those trials come to an end, there's not so much of a conversation with the ancillary departments internally as to when those authorizations are going to switch from trial visits to standard of care, and then if they come to blood and marrow transplant, how are those studies then, when they begin, now it's switching back to, now these are going to be billed towards the trial, and then of course when that comes to an end, it's switching back to standard of care. So sometimes we get into these instances where we have patients coming in who are telling us, you know, it's going to be billed to my trial, but then they get these bills. So if that happens early on for trials maybe in other departments, and then they do come to us and vice versa, it can be very off-putting to the patient. So they might not necessarily want to then sign up for the trial in that term, just because they have gone through a lot of hardships. And of course, with the extent of everything that, you know, we see day to day, the financial aspect is not something that we want to kind of put on their shoulders in addition to everything else that they're already going through at the time. So I think kind of just paying close attention to the patient timelines. That also goes in partnership with the kind of how far the patients even have to come to the centers, because a lot of the times a transplant center might not be as close to them as you would think. So while it might be a great idea to have a trial that has upwards of 30 visits in 1 year, yes, that may be fantastic, but that might be very unrealistic for patients who are traveling very long distances when the financial support isn't there for them.
So. Yeah, I want to come back to that topic of the financial aspect, and I don't know that we as an industry often think about the financial impact on the trial participants, right? At least those of us who aren't involved in running studies like me. I've been a consumer of CRO services. I've observed design of studies, but I've never gotten to that level of detail. I don't know that a lot of folks in the industry really think very much about it. Let's come back to that one. So Aaron, on this subject, so you've been both a consumer of CRO services at Boston Scientific and maybe other places, and now you're running a CRO yourself. To what extent are you able to, in your current role, to negotiate with sponsors kind of on these elements of study design that you think are very important for implementation? Are you able to push back? Do they listen? Or is it more of a situation where it's very, very difficult to get sponsors to change their minds, even when well-reasoned?
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are coming to us to run clinical trials understand that we do have this niche expertise in cell and gene therapy, which is, you know, they want to come to us because we have access to the data that can help make informed decisions, to help inform the trial design, and then also because we have the in-house scientific expertise with individuals such as Heather to be able to, you know, sit down with the sponsor organization and help design the protocol in such a way that we're really being mindful about the endpoints and the schedule of events or what we're asking of the patients as well. Because I think that's really one of the key points is that you can, these protocols are often, you know, developed in a void. You are in a theoretical space of, I think this will work. Yes, I think it's worked like this in the past. But then when you get, you know, from Gabby's perspective, then boots to the ground, some things can really fall apart. So having that expertise, answer your question directly, I think most sponsors really are, because if you can say, we know that this will really impact the outcomes and our ability to collect the data, if you could modify this, or we know that this, to Heather's point, is standard of care, so let's pull back on the data collection here because we don't need it. It's not an investigational point of the study, so we don't need this and we can lower the barrier. So I have, you know, generally found that people are receptive if we can point to actually a conclusion or an endpoint that this will make things go more quickly, it will help ease the burden on patients or sites, and also get to the end of the study more quickly.
Yeah, we, you know, we have a modality that's phenomenally complex. It's complex to manufacture, it's complex to deliver, it's complex to manage side effects. And to some degree, at least early on, being just a few years ago, it was very difficult to predict exactly what some of these externalities were going to be, right? So we were guessing. But through, you know, now we've been through a lot of studies. There's been quite a bit of data accumulated. I think we have a pretty good handle on what generally side effects are. And I kind of want to go down a path now of talking about implementing studies in the non-centers of excellence context, because I think this is something that we read about in the press quite a bit. There's been some developers that are very aggressively marketing that these are going to be outpatient therapies at some point. And it makes sense, right? If we want broad patient access, we want these to be outpatient therapies, we want them to be accessible in the non-centers of excellence, we should be able to run studies in the non-centers of excellence as well. I am very, very doubtful that that's going to happen based on my reading of the toxicity profiles of the therapies, but you three are much more advanced in this than I am. So Heather, I'd like to start with you. Do you envision a future where let's say CAR T therapies, especially with the known neurotoxicities, difficult to manage toxicities in general, are we going to see these move into the community oncology setting? Is that where we're going to see not just administration but also studies run in the near future, do you think?
So that's a really difficult question. I would say potentially, but not the way the current CARs are, because there is too much neurotoxicity, there's too much cytokine release syndrome. If you don't have a core group of people, and I mean nurses, physicians, nurse managers, pharmacists, an ICU that's available at that hospital that is going to know how to mitigate those toxicities when they happen, that's never gonna work because those patients are gonna die, right? If you think about transplant, it's such, in general, right? It's such a specific niche, like not anybody can just do a bone marrow transplant because they don't understand what's gonna happen. And so I think if as therapies get easier, yes, but for clinical trials, I mean, I think about everything that goes into a clinical trial, and even this, it seems silly, but labs need to be drawn a certain way, okay? Like certain days you need a green top, a purple top, a blue top, two red tops, and guess what? They're not all going to the same place. They're going to five different places, right? You need all of those shipping labels, and you need to know where they're going, and if the hospital doesn't have support for someone to do that, then clinical trials aren't going to get done. If they don't have an IRB, if they don't have more oversight, they're not going to get done. But ideally, yes, you do want if there was a CAR T that was easy, had less side effects, and you could go home the next day, then sure. But I don't think that that will be here for another 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, I think obviously the field is working towards it. We all want to see it happen. It does feel a little bit ways away.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go again to Gabby, if you don't mind, Aaron. So, you know, one of the benefits, of course, of working with Moffitt, you've done these studies before. You have experience doing it. And that means, in this particular context, being able to manage the side effects of the therapies. Are you seeing the side effects of the therapies every year, you know, the time span that you're supporting trials? Are you seeing them decreasing, the adverse events decreasing, less toxicity? And also, are we in fact getting better at managing the side effects? This is what we're reading anyway in the press, that we are getting better at it.
I would say from 3 years ago when I initially started, it definitely was shocking to see, especially with my first exposure into it. However, now I do believe, especially with the trials that we are using, especially for some of those preventative therapies, for example, like graft versus host disease prevention trials, those symptom managements, although they're not FDA approved as of yet for the use of it, however, I do think we are improving, not significantly. I think there's a large amount of room for improvement, but I will say I do think that it is improving, but I don't necessarily know if that is because it is more controlled, or if it is only being relayed to the clinical trial teams, for example, if it meets a grade 3 to be reported. So, you know, those grade 1 and 2 events, I'm not aware of more than half the time. So it's kind of a gray area, I would say. So I can't completely say that I confidently say that we're improving, but from what I'm experiencing, I would say yes.
Can I just make one comment about that? I also think that we're getting better at the types of patients that are getting the CAR T therapy. And so where before on the clinical trial, you know, it's the worst of the worst, they have an 80% disease burden coming in, you know that patient's not gonna do well. Now patients are coming to these CAR Ts with no disease burden, and we find that they actually do better. So I think we might be getting better at symptom management, but the patients that are coming there are much different.
Okay, yeah, let's come back to that one in a second as well. So Aaron, again, going to, you know, the running of studies, I'm really interested in this topic of moving beyond the centers of excellence. Your CRO does a lot of work with transplant centers of excellence, right? There's correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a 20-center network in particular that's critical to the running of your studies, the BMT, CTN. Are you considering moving your studies outside of that center of excellence arena?
You know, when we do center selection is obviously a big topic right now for clinical trials, because we know selecting the right centers really sets your trial up for success. So looking at the data that's available on, you know, which centers have the patient population, and, you know, we can look at historical CIBMTR outcomes numbers for the registry data to do some of that center selection. You know, honestly, I would say that we haven't so much, just because there's such a strain in the infrastructure right now at even the existing centers of excellence. You know, it's hard enough for them to recruit the site coordinators, the research nurses, to be able to run the clinical center. So I haven't really, in the cell and gene therapy space, seen a lot of movement outside of those centers. I think just for the sheer fact of being able to uphold that infrastructure, because we're seeing it even at the big centers that we go to right now. We might, you know, they might be selected as a first tier site that we want to approach, but they'll say, you know, yes, we're really interested in this trial, but it's 6 months out before we can even get it through our study approvals because we're so backlogged right now. So, I mean, I'm hoping it's coming, because, you know, moving beyond these centers will only increases the opportunity for diversity of clinical clinical trial participants. So I think we will move that way eventually.
It makes sense, right? We know, I forgot to introduce myself, by the way. So I lead sales and business development for Be The Match Biotherapies, which is a vendor to the cell therapy industry. So when I'm about to refer to my clients, it's a pretty good cross representation of the industry as a whole. What I hear from our clients at Be The Match Biotherapies is that slow trial recruitment, it's sinking companies. It's that slow, right? The pressure level in this bad financial environment is ratcheting up even higher than it was before, and it was already high. And study enrollment is one of the things that these companies report out on in their quarterly board meetings. It's one of the primary data readouts for them. and they're way behind. And in some cases, that's causing them to cancel programs because of the financial realities of having to support overhead, honestly, over more months than you thought you were going to. So when we get to this issue, Heather, you just mentioned something really important, which is the right, picking the right patients, right? You talked about picking patients that are low probability of suffering from the toxicities. Makes a ton of sense. When you were in Minnesota and you were, let's say you were looking at possible trial enrollees and you wanted to pick ones that you thought would suffer from fewer toxicities, what is the calculus there for you in terms of trial enrollment rates? Does it matter to you as an investigator that the trial was supposed to enroll one patient a month, but in fact it's only enrolling one patient a quarter, but that patient's a really good patient in your mind? Is that a factor in your thinking?
So I would say, what's the factor is you always want the best, obviously, for the patient. And it really depends on the trial. So, you know, some trials are going to allow for toxicities. And what I would say about the, what I meant was commercialization. What we learned with Kymriah is that the patients that were going to Kymriah were had less disease burden and were a much better fit, is what I would say, than the clinical trial. And that's what we're probably going to learn for other things, right? Because some clinical trials are taking the worst of the worst because this is their last hope. Some clinical trials have, you know, they're too stringent. And it's like, we're never going to find that perfect patient, you know? And so it's a mix. And I would say I would feel bad about enrollment if we weren't getting a patient on the trial. But at the same time, it's like, if I don't have a patient, I don't have a patient, and I can't make them fit to that. And it truly depends on how easy the clinical trial is and what your patient population is. Like, we did the cord blood study, the CTN trial that was 0501, I believe, and that was one cord versus two cords for pediatrics. We enrolled a ton of patients on that because I did a ton of cord blood transplants. That wasn't difficult. And I, you know, they had easy eligibility. You know, it was leukemia, blah, you know, like, and you could fit it. If it's going to be so stringent and you're never going to find a patient like that, then that's going to be a problem. And I also think sometimes the companies, I hope that sites are getting much better now about charging the companies more for each patient because they're not getting the reimbursement that they deserve when you think about everybody that had to touch that patient. Mm-hmm. You know, so they might say, oh, we're just going to pay you $10,000 per patient. Well, that's never going to cover absolutely everything that they need to do because, you know, think of all the CRF forms, like everything, the data forms that they have to fill out, all of the labs, the research labs, what they have to report, the audits, like that just, it doesn't cover it. And then you lose people in the clinical trials office and you don't have enough people.
Yeah, this financial aspect Gabby raised early on, and I am going to come back to this because this is a really rich subject. Before we go there, I want to stay on recruitment because recruitment, I keep hearing again, this is a huge problem in the field. So I'm going to mix up my order. I'm going to go to Aaron this time. So trial recruitment, you have experience with academic investigator-initiated studies, also corporate studies. You know, reputationally, one would think, reputationally, the academic studies are lower pressure on trial enrollment rates. I don't know if that's true or not, that's reputation. But I am curious about your experience working with both. And if it is true that corporate-sponsored studies, there's more pressure, does it actually result in faster study completion, or does it get in the way of study completion? Are the academic studies actually easier to conduct and therefore completed earlier? Any thoughts on trial enrollment rates and those pressures?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of nuances to that. Clinical trials are, you know, most of the clinical trials run the same, regardless of it's an academic sponsor or a corporate industry sponsor. You know, what's a little bit different maybe is the pressure and the timelines, although we get that with grant funding as well, where the government essentially mandates certain timelines or they won't continue to fund you. I would say a couple of key things playing into that, which really does affect recruitment, is relationships. Relationships, communication, and protocol design are really some of the key things we see making a difference. And so it can be issues for corporate-sponsored or academic research. as well. So if you don't have a protocol designed in a way that a transplant center can operationalize it or implement it, or they think it's too complex, then they don't really want to put patients on it because it's just too much work. And at a time when staffing is already an issue, they don't want to put all their efforts into like managing a single protocol. And we see also that sites, and Gabby, you can tell me if I'm off base on this, but we see them wanting good communication as well. So if it's a, you know, if we're running an academic study and we have good communication, or a sponsor has really good communication, the sites appreciate that, and that can really help with the enrollment. If they get a quick, accurate answer on, you know, eligibility or, you know, can I do this, they're more apt to continue on with that protocol. You know, so those are really a couple of the things. And then it's just the relationships. Honestly, how you treat the centers, you know, we as a CRO, we really try to nurture the relationship with our transplant center because they're such a valuable resource. They're the one, you know, doing so much of the work for the clinical trial. So, you know, sponsors that work with the CRO or they themselves are running the trial, if they are really treating the hospitals, the transplant centers as a client or as, you know, a true partner or collaborator, that really can impact how much you want to recruit. Because sometimes, you know, you may not have the patients, but you really want to get the patients. And so that little oomph can push you over into meeting your recruitment goals.
I want to pursue maybe somewhat of a controversial angle on this with Gabby, but you do not feel compelled to answer this question if it's too awkward or something. But I know from our own experience, there are certain sponsors that are very difficult to work with. They're kind of a pain in the rear, honestly. And, you know, I think there's some training that goes on in biopharma, and I come from biopharma. You get your training in biopharma like you would in residency, Heather. You learn those techniques, that becomes your style. And there's certain companies that are run by people who are incredibly pushy. They always think they're right. They think they're smarter than everyone else, and therefore they just bend everyone to their will. And I don't think it works well in study recruitment, in study implementation. But I would love to know, you know, from your perspective, and Aaron alluded to it a little bit, there's just some studies that are very complicated, they're difficult. You have financial aspects you raised, Gabby, that might make you say, I just don't feel like enrolling someone in this study. But the pushiness of sponsors, either through the CRO or directly, what are your thoughts on that? Is it effective? Does it bring their study to the top of your mind, and then you start enrolling, or are you thinking, I hate this sponsor?
I would say no, it doesn't encourage us at all. I definitely think that sometimes it even discourages us in a sense, because if you do try to recruit patients who, like she mentioned earlier, there are certain patients who do fit the study, and then there's certain ones who maybe aren't such a good choice, but those patients now come into that loop because you're so pressured to recruit all these people that it's not that perfect group of patients anymore. Now it does go out into that group of patients that may not be the best fit, but do meet eligibility, so let's go for it. And also, it kind of brings it to the point of, these are human beings, these are people. So we can't just go up to everybody we see and just try to get them to be on this clinical trial if it isn't the best for them long-term. And also if it's kind of just, I don't know, I just think the presentation of it just makes it a lot more pressure on us, but also I think that pressure is definitely conveyed into the communication that we give not only to the PIs that we work with, but especially the patients that we're trying to put on the trial.
Thanks for joining us today, and be sure to come back again for the second half of this episode, where our panelists dive deeper into cost considerations in cell and gene therapy clinical trials, and how close collaboration between clinical trial sites and research sponsors is key to success.